Hi, this is Frank Allen of The Searchers, and you're listening to Suzanne Hunter's World of Arts and Entertainment on Brooklyn's Radio.
Now, it's a real pleasure to welcome onto the show Frank Allen from The Searchers. Great to talk to you today.
Very nice to talk to you as well.
Now, all your fans will know you're the much-loved bass guitarist with The Searchers.
Yes, all both of them will know.
So, of course, I mean, you have also been a bass guitarist for Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, but you also were a rhythm guitarist. What led to the change, and when did your love affair with the guitar start?
Gosh, you are going back now, aren't you? Right, let's start with the love affair with the guitar. I mean, I suppose it started when rock and roll came in the mid-50s. It was Elvis, it was Bill Haley, Buddy Holly, all of these people had guitars, and the guitar became the romantic and the sexy instrument, and I desperately wanted one. Like most kids, I just kept on at my parents till they bought me a cheap guitar. Gradually learned bits and bits, so I became a guitarist of sort, not greatly competent, you know, but enough to get into little bands and improve. Eventually, after quite a long spell in semi-pro, amateur and semi-pro outfits, I got the chance to join, as you said, Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers. I was 17, just about 17 and a half, I think. It was the middle of 1961. Always wanted to be in that band because it was absolutely a fabulous outfit for the first time I ever saw them. So I talked my way into the band as rhythm guitar. And then how I changed over was at the end of 61, three people were leaving and we got replacements, but we couldn't get the bass player we wanted. So the decision was made that we would cut out rhythm guitar because it wasn't really needed anyway. I mean, to be honest, I talked them into taking on a rhythm guitarist, and I knew they didn't need it when they took me on, but I so much wanted that job. I did the best-selling job you could ever imagine. Anyway, so they reckon the best idea was for me to switch over from rhythm guitar onto bass, which I could quite easily do. So the last week in December 61, I was a rhythm guitarist, and the first week of 62, I was a bass player.
Ah, well, very multi-talented person, obviously.
Well, no, just very clever. making sure that I was firmly embedded in that band. I mean, being a bass player was a much more secure position than being a rhythm guitarist. It was a big band. They didn't really need one. I mean, we had saxes, pianos, things like that.
Oh, yeah, it's an incredible band, isn't it? I mean, yeah. They're both incredible, Cliff and the Searchers.
Yeah.
Now, it seems to be the way with so many bands that they have changes in lineups. And after the hit Sweets for My Sweet and Sugar and Spice, you were asked to sing a dual lead line on the song When You Walk in the Room. How did that feel?
It was great. It was actually mid-64. They'd had a few other hits after Sweets for My Sweet and Sugar. I missed the first year of the band. Although, actually, I'd met them in Germany in 63 before they even went into a recording studio. They just turned professional to go to the Star Club. And as you mentioned about Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, we were already a professional band of long standing. We'd made about 6 records by that time. So we were, at that point, a bigger deal than them. But suddenly they got their chance to get into a studio, got signed, and went straight to number one. So they were immediately much, much bigger than us. So my friends I used to hang around with for that year while they're having things like Sweet Smoke, Sweet Sugar and Spice, Needles and Pins, Don't Throw Your Love Away. And in mid-64, I was having dinner with Chris Curtis, the drummer, in London, and he explained that they weren't getting on with Tony Jackson, the bass player, and they were going to have a change, and did I want the job? And I kind of hummed and ahed for quite a while. Eventually, I thought, because I didn't want to be disloyal to the Rebel Rousers, but anyway, someone made me see sense, and eventually I said, well, yeah, if you still want to offer me the job, then I'm up for it.
And the rest is history.
The lead line, we didn't mention the lead line, yeah. Went into the studios pretty much straight away. I joined August the 3rd, 64. It was time for a new record, so as soon as we got a few weeks of dates out of the way, we went to the studio, and we decided on When You Walk in the Room. And just to give it a different edge than the vocal sound they'd had before, I think it was Chris Curtis who suggested that Mike and I should sing the lead line in unison. And that's what happened. And I can clearly, and so can the band, clearly hear my voice in the mix there somewhere. I mean, Mike was always the lead singer at that point. You know, I'm not a lead singer, but it was very, very nice to at least say that I did sing lead on one of our big hits.
Absolutely. I mean, it's such a wonderful combination, a great sound. And I mean, talking of sound, the guitar and the vocals are very distinctive. Can you pinpoint the time when you sort of discovered that unique 12-string sound, and did the songs form themselves quite easily?
The 12-string came about kind of by accident. You know, in the mid-60s, well, as about 64 came in, the 12-string guitar started to get a bit popular, mostly in the folk area. People like Bob Dylan and all sorts of people were using, or the, you know, yeah, I can't remember the other people, but the acoustic 12-string guitar was very, very popular, and people recognized the sound. When Needles and Pins came out, people thought that the band had used an electric 12-string on that, because that jangly sound made it sound like a 12-string. But in fact, there was no 12-string, it was just two 6-strings, you know, resonating together and giving it that kind of sound. But it was obviously intriguing people, so we thought, well, maybe we should do something about this. There had been a couple of album tracks before that using acoustic 12-string, but not to any great effect. So when You Walk in the Room came out, we decided that we would do the riff on a 12-string guitar. We didn't actually have one at the time. The only people making real 12-strings were the Rickenbacker Company, and we didn't have one of those. And then Burns Guitars in Britain were making them, so we had them send round a 12-string, a Burns Double Six that we used on When You Walk in the Room. And pretty soon afterwards, we got a 12-string in the band as well. But yeah, When You Walk in the Room was the first one that we actually used a 12-string as the lead instrument. And you can clearly hear it in that, I mean, definitely, that iconic riff of When You Walk in the Room. It's one of the most identifiable things about any pop song from that era.
Definitely. I mean, talking of that, I mean, it must have contributed to the amount of hits that you had. Did you ever think you were going to be so hugely popular? And incidentally, what do you think is the secret formula musically for making a hit record?
Hugely popular. Well, they were hugely popular before I came into the band, so I had no input in making them popular. I didn't know they were going to become hugely popular. I mean, when I met them as friends. I liked their sound, but it didn't occur to me that they were going to be big stars, or even stars of any way at all, because bands outside London didn't used to get recording contracts. Well, of course, it was the Beatles, really, who changed everything. I mean, once they kicked all the doors down, then everything was focused on Liverpool, and suddenly the music from there and the accent was the flavour of the month. So everyone had a really serious chance of making it. And the reason why some bands made it and some others didn't was, well, first of all, some people had their finger on the pulse of what was happening. They could pick the right songs. That's always the most important thing in anyone having any hits, is being able to choose the right material. Of course, on top of that, you've got to have an appeal that resonates with the public. I mean, the Searchers were an attractive band. They were a very smart band. But, you know, they're up there with all the other dozens of bands that were being put into the frame at the time. But they did have the knack of picking great songs. I mean, Sweets for My Sweet was just a fantastic first record. And Tony Hatch wrote a brilliant follow-up in Sugar and Spice. And then, of course, they changed the whole format and got to Needles and Pins with all the harmonies. And that's where the long-standing identifiable sound of the Searchers came from. Once they changed over to that the softer sound, and the very intricate and very effective harmonies, that's what everyone remembers: the 12-string, the harmonies, and the lovely melodies. So it was just a matter of realizing what would be commercial. And I'll tell you, one of the main things that the Searchers always had, and I'm giving them the credit, not myself, because as I say, I jumped in 64, they had the knack of what I call musical asset stripping. They wouldn't just take a song and copy it, which is what we did with Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers. They were to take it, they would rip it apart and reassemble it, keeping all the good bits and adding really cute bits of their own and making it into a really strong product. I mean, I listened on a radio show the other day to the original version of Don't Throw Your Love Away, which was a B-side by a group called the Orlons. Well, it's rubbish. I don't know how they ever saw the potential in that song, because it doesn't sound commercial. It doesn't sound catchy. They took that song, reconstructed it, and made it fantastic. You know, and that was the reason for the Searchers' success anyway.
Yes. I suppose it's like a DJ, you know, taking a sample and just seeing something in it that might mix with a dance and a disco track that sort of gels. The Searchers must have seen something.
Having your finger on the pulse, that's what it's really all about.
Absolutely.
And that's where producers come into their own. They can see what is going to happen with the kids who really buy the records.
Absolutely. And like you said, I mean, it was just so much abundance of creativity in the 60s. It was so diverse. Each band was very unique.
Yeah.
And you did headline over and above some pretty amazing individuals. You know, a former guest on my show, Motown legend Martha Reeves, as well as Marvin Gaye and The Temptations. It must have been incredible. What was the atmosphere like backstage? Did you all get on well?
That was fantastic. That was as soon as after I joined them, we went off on this tour across the world, which started in New York, and we were doing these shows at the Fox Theatre in Brooklyn. We did 7 days of concerts there, and we were doing six shows a day. It was the most amazing setup that Americans had. They started at 10 in the morning, finished at 10 at night, and they had all these acts. And this is the bill of every show that was there. It was the Searchers. We were a big deal at the time, because anything with a British accent was really, you know, they ruled. So there was the Searchers, Dusty Springfield, Millie, all from the UK, and then from America it was Marvin Gaye, Martha and the Vandellas, the Supremes, Smokey Robinson, the Miracles, the Temptations, the Contours, Little Anthony, the Shangri-Las, the Ronettes, the Dovells, Jay and the Americans, and the New Beats. And, I mean, can you imagine putting a show on like that? Now, that would fill arenas. I mean, Marvin could fill arenas on his own these days. And they were all legends, all those people. Backstage, the atmosphere was good, except that. The one thing I regret about that was there were so many people on that bill, and the Fox Theatre was a very up-and-down theatre. You know, there were small floors, but lots of different levels. And there wasn't actually a big green room where everyone could congregate and sit down and have a drink together. So we missed a lot of the fraternizing. You'd pass people in the corridors, and you'd see them as they came off stage. And I think next to us on our floor were the Ronettes. So we saw more of them. We went into their dressing room and had chats and drinks with them. But there was a lot of missed opportunities.
Oh, that's a bit of a shame. I suppose it's a little bit different now. Everyone's all put into one green room and sort of mingle around. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing, amazing times. But, I mean, bands, as you know, can be like chalk and cheese when put on a tour schedule. And former guest Barry Whitwam talked about touring on the same bill as Keith Moon and his colourful antics. Now, you've been quoted as saying touring with the Stones was like Mother Teresa and Vlad the Impaler.
Yeah.
So who was who?
I'm kidding. You would think it would... Well, I mean, it's obvious that the Stones would be Vlad the Impaler, but it's interesting you should mention that because... the Stones on that tour were behaving really like perfect gentlemen. Harry Miller, who promoted the tour, recalled in his autobiography that he found the Beatles very stroppy when they worked out there and didn't really get on with them at all. And he found the Stones perfect gentlemen. And now on that tour, we were having real troubles with Chris Curtis, our drummer, who'd suddenly kind of gone off the rails. And he collapsed before a TV show in Sydney. I mean, the 2 minutes before we walked on, we had to walk on with three people in the end while he was rushed into hospital. He fell off the stage at Sydney because he was out of his head on pills or something like that and cut his finger. And he was behaving really oddly. I mean, and by the end of the tour, he'd decided he wasn't going to be a Searcher anymore. So, when we had these dramas with the TV show and all that, the promoter, Harry Miller, had to come into the dressing room and sort of say, look, Chris, you've got to get your act together. If you don't, I'm going to call the cops and I'm going to blow the whistle on you. So there were the Stones acting with perfect decorum, and the Searchers were embroiled in a drug scandal. I mean, how ridiculous.
That's a turn-up for the books, isn't it?
It certainly is a turn-up for us, because, I mean, this is the most drug-free band you'd ever find in your life.
Yes, well, no wonder you had to make a swift exit.
Yeah.
Now, you performed and toured all over the world, and a huge Down Under in Australia, as well as in the States, and, of course, the UK. But, you know, would you say playing to 80,000 people at Wembley was one of your highlights, and what other memories can you share?
Probably the highlight, mm-hmm. because where else would we have got the chance to play to that kind of crowd? I mean, I admit, you know, some people came to see Cliff as well. I better explain to the people out there, this 80,000 people was not for the Searchers. Cliff was celebrating his 30th anniversary in show business, and I'd become a slight mate of his, and he invited us to be on the show, which is fantastic. He's been a great supporter. We've done all sorts of shows. We did Millennium New Year's Eve with him. We've done some charity shows for him. Great guy, and I'm supporting you in everything that's going on now. And he just invited us to be on the show, and it was the most incredible opportunity. We'll always be so grateful for that. So that really was the biggest event that we've ever done. But the other things I remember are, well, first of all, the shows I mentioned at the Brooklyn Fox, just because of that incredible lineup that you'll never see again. And the other one was the 1981 Royal Variety Show, where we got presented to the Queen. So I think those are there are a lot of high points in our career, but those are the three I always mention.
Absolutely. I mean, I was going to say audiences are so diverse, and you have performed to the Queen. Was that a nerve-wracking experience?
It was. I don't think particularly because Her Majesty was there. It's just that it was so quick. We were only doing one song, Did we do two? Okay, no, we did one song, yeah. I mean, there was a segment in the middle of the show where they went through the ages of British pop. So they had about eight or nine performers, like us, Marty Wilde, Lonnie Donegan, Anita Harris. It was, just went through some, Alvin Stardust, Adam and the Ants. And, one person came on, did their big hit song, and then someone else came on. But it still was very nerve-wracking. I mean, you're playing to about 20 million people, and especially as we were, it's a long time since we'd had serious television exposure. So to do that was a fantastic opportunity and quite sort of overwhelming.
Now, you're such a hard-working band, and you've enjoyed lots of extensive touring as well as playing for and entertaining the troops. What was the feeling like doing that?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because they are the things we did for the troops were the most memorable things ever. Unique. It's like no other work we've ever done, particularly the shows in the Falklands and in Bosnia. And we also did Belfast a few times, and we did shows on the HMS Illustrious going down the Mediterranean from Gibraltar to Marseille, I think it was. And the Falklands is really astonishing. You play in these little mountain camps, and Falklands is a really bleak place, but it's like, it's male bonding like you've never seen. You play in a camp to 40 people. That's all there is in there, in this their little canteen. And they are wild. And then you get off stage, and then you go and drink all night with them. And they have their own little customs and routines and atmosphere. I couldn't even begin to describe it in an interview as short as this. But then we also played Bosnia. We were taken over, and we played Sarajevo on... Well, we arrived there the night they started shelling Sarajevo. In fact, it was so heavy at that time that I think the first show was cancelled because it was too dangerous. And then the second night we were going off to a place called Gornji Vrh, I think it was, and we were actually waiting for a helicopter to be repaired before we could get in it and going up to one of these outlying places. And that's a bit nerve-wracking, waiting for a helicopter to be repaired. I mean, they're not the most safe things in the world anyway. You know, it's like flying in the air in a giant egg whisk. I'm not mad about that. But but it was all a great adventure. And we did one concert in Ploče, which was the main camp. It was the largest deployment of forces in Europe at the time under canvas. We played to about 2,000 people under this massive tent. Young kids who'd never heard of us didn't want us. We'd been booked by the officers. And we started off, and after about the second or third song, they really got into it, and the place was erupting. And we actually did Johnny B. Goode at one point, and two of the young squaddies got onto the stage with machine guns, and they did the Chuck Berry duck walk towards each other for each side of the stage to the tune of Johnny B. Goode waving these machine guns. Bizarre. And at the end of the thing, the whole of the place stood on their benches and did the Wayne's World bow, chanting, "We are not worthy." I mean, that is the best reaction to any show we've ever had.
Oh, wow. That sounds absolutely incredible.
I've still got pictures of the audience that night watching us, and it was amazing.
Oh, wow. That's just such an experience, isn't it?
Yep.
And I bet they loved it.
We're at that concert, then you'll know what it was like.
Yeah. They're still in recovery.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, it isn't just the soldiers who are fans of yours. Your contemporaries and your fellow musicians also greatly admire you, from Tom Petty, Bruce Springsteen and the Byrds. They've all cited you as massive influences. And you've even had legendary punk pioneer Marky Ramone sit on the drums for Needles and Pins.
Yeah, that's
How did that come about?
We were going to do some shows in America. We were doing a place called The Cutting Room in New York, which we'd done two or three times. And we got word by a friend of Marky's that he was a great fan of the band. Well, actually, we knew they were great fans because Joey Ramone had actually come to see our show at the Lone Star Cafe, I think it was, in the early 80s. And anyway, Marky he sent this message via this guy called Gary that he loved the band and would it be possible for him to sit in on Needles and Pins? So we said, yes, by all means. So he came along, brought his own drumsticks, and we invited him up, and he was fantastic. He's become a bit of a friend now, and it was great. The clip is actually still on YouTube, and so Yeah. And he's just got his autobiography out, so I don't know if he mentions that evening in the autobiography. But,
I think he will.
No, that was great. He's a lovely guy, and far from being wild, he's the quietest, most unassuming person you've ever met. Yeah. So that was pretty special.
The other people
you mentioned have been, we've never met Springsteen, but John McNally was invited to the show in Manchester, and Springsteen's band, believe it or not, actually got there late that night, so they didn't have time to meet anyone, but Stevie Van Zandt came out and chatted to John, and they had a long talk about 12 Strings. But yeah, he still does When You Walk in the Room in his show every now and again. There are two clips on YouTube of Bruce doing When You Walk in the Room. Tom Petty said in a recent survey for Goldmine magazine, where he had to pick his top 10 British Invasion songs, When You Walk in the Room was at number 5, and he said, I had to stop myself picking a whole bunch of Searcher stuff because they had great vocals and the 12-string guitar was really intriguing. So nice coming from him. And the Byrds, a long laugh, admitted, in fact, Chris Hillman said it more than Roger McGuinn, that they were influenced by us more than they were the Beatles. I've got that quote somewhere. And it said that they borrowed a lot, they borrowed stuff from us. They said that at the time they were recording Mr. Tambourine, they borrowed an awful lot from the Searchers. Great, isn't it?
I think definitely listeners are going to have to go to the YouTube and see some of this in action. I think that would be great.
Yeah, as I say, the Springsteen thing there and the Marky Ramone thing is there.
Yeah, wonderful. Now, I mean, talking of John McNally just a moment ago there, bands do break up, reform, start again. So it is wonderful that you and John, the original, are still together.
And I always give Tony credit for what he did in the band before me on some of the absolute major hits, you know.
Yeah.
And I also give credit to Mike Pender, who we fell out with most spectacularly at the end of 85. But you know, who would ever deny Mike his place in the band? I mean, it was a much more important position than me at that time. And he sang lead on Needles and Pins and Don't Throw Your Love Away and things. So, you know. I'm not going to be ungenerous in praise there.
Yeah.
But
you have got some new members with you on the tour now. How's that affected the band, and what can audiences sort of expect from the tour?
Well, it was a big dramatic thing when Mike left. We eventually, John and I discussed it. Big shock. We didn't know actually whether it was time to give up or what would happen. A big, you know, major change in the band. Eventually, we decided to reorganized, and we got Spencer James in on lead vocals. And once we'd made the decision and got the person, we went into it, put money into the show, we got lights in, and really thought about the whole thing. Because, you know, previous to that, yeah, everything would be fine. We didn't know there was going to be a change in the band. You know, there was discontentment, obviously. There wasn't a good atmosphere. We weren't really communicating with each other, so we couldn't improve the show that much. But once we'd made the break, or Mike had made the break, we got on with reorganizing our show, and we put a lot of thought into it. And that's the kind of thing that stood us in good stead for the kind of all-evening shows that we do now. We had to present a better product than we had before, because we were in a very vulnerable position. And in the end, we went into the most successful decades financially and artistically since the hit days. I mean, you can't replace the hit days between 63 and 66, but having made this big change, then we reinvented ourselves and created a product that is now a major force in the level of bands that we work in.
Well, that's good, isn't it? The quality is still there, and the essence, the true essence of the band. I mean, the good news is you're on tour again, and you've got many dates in the UK, including some Surrey venues. You're going to be at Dorking Hall on the 14th of April, Croydon Ashford on the 15th of April, and Hazelmere Hall eagerly awaits you on the 27th of April. Are you looking forward to doing the shows?
Oh, yeah, we look forward to our shows every night. And we create this amazing loyalty in people. They come again and again. They get to know other people in the audience. They get to know other people via our website. And they travel to different parts of the country. And the atmosphere of one of the All Evening shows is fantastic. I mean, I don't know if people know. If they haven't been to a show, then they won't know what we do. But we in fact, take over the whole evening. We go on. We play an hour. We have a 20-minute interval. Then we go on and play another hour. And during that time, we're constantly changing the set, by the way. So you're never likely to get the show totally the same two nights. We include not just the big hits. We go through a lot of the early album tracks, a lot of the B-sides. We do a couple of selections from our later recording periods for the people who stuck with us through that. There are a few tributes to people we've toured with, golden classics, and it's very much all the kind of music that our kind of crowd love. And I think that once you get to one of our shows, then we pretty much got you hooked for the, well, however long our little legs will carry us on stage.
I mean, it sounds absolutely amazing. All those smash hits, I Love Love Potion Number 9 and Don't Throw Your Love Away and so many others. You've had...
Well, they're all there.
Yeah.
But you know, you got all those little rarities that are there, the B-sides. I mean, we just rearranged the show just a few nights ago and put in four songs that haven't been in for... Well, two that have never, ever been in the show since the 60s. That's a song called He's Got No Love, which was the follow-up to Goodbye, My Love. And Sea of Heartbreak, which was from the 1964 It's the Searchers album. We switched around what was the current choice from the Sire records, from Hearts in a Rise to It's Too Late. We put in Farmer John again. Goodbye, My Love hadn't been in the show for a while, so that's back in. Constantly changing concept, and which we can do because everything we do is live. There's no pre-recorded stuff in our show.
You will be playing to packed audiences, and what do you think the secret of the band's success is? What keeps you going, and will you keep going indefinitely?
We love what we do, and we care about what we do, and we care about the people who come to see us. Also, we have our health. We've kept ourselves pretty fit. None of us got any serious illnesses or disabilities. We have no problems with movement or actually getting to the gigs or going on stage. And we have an audience that will fill the places to make it a feasible and viable option. See those three things in place, then you can go on for as long as you have your health, and as long as you want to do it. They're the two main things.
Absolutely. Of course, music, I think it just keeps you young anyway, doesn't it? It's so amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, you think young and suddenly you are young. I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm 71. John McNally's 73. He'll be 74 this year. But I don't think it shows in us at all. I don't believe I'm that age. I'm 25 as far as I'm concerned.
No, absolutely. The thing is, it's such fun, isn't it? It's fun getting up there and performing to people.
Because music, you're thinking young all your life, and you tend to care about what you look like and care about how you dress, everything you do, and care. You know, your whole attitude is young, and consequently, you tend to maintain a youthful appearance.
Yeah, or what's on the inside's on the outside, isn't it?
So,
yeah. Well, it's been an absolute joy to talk to you today, Frank. I know the tour is going to be a huge success, and I wish you all the very best, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on the show. Couldn't do it without you. Got to get the message out there, and look forward to seeing everyone at the one of those shows you mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for your time again today.
Thanks. Bye, Suzanne.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was my very special guest, the fantastic Frank Allen from The Searchers.
Suzanne Hunter, bringing you the world of arts and entertainment in Surrey and beyond on Brooklyn's Radio.
Brooklyn's Radio. Loving arts and entertainment.